Take it for granted.
I call the meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Please take your seats. We are going to move one of our bill authors up to the front. She has a number of bills up now, so I want to welcome Representative Liebling to our committee. And it's for House File 1540, and I will move the House File 1540 be referred to Ways and Means. Yes, testifiers today, would you like to do opening comments and then introduce your testifiers, please?
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill, and thank you for letting me go first, because we're moving things around pretty fast today. But so this is a bill that I think fills a very important need, which is to have more pediatricians trained to deal with sort of the everyday mental health issues that arise. And the reason it's in this committee is that this is a program that's being, a request that's being brought to us from the pediatric residency program at the University of Minnesota. So with that, I would just like to turn it over to my testifiers to give some brief comments about the bill.
Okay, who would you like to, which doctor would you like to start?
Okay, Dr. Borman Shope.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Yeah. If you could please state your name and your organization that, and begin your testimony, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for hearing us today. I'm Dr. Emily Borman Shope. I'm the Vice Chair of Education and the Pediatric Residency Program Director at the University of Minnesota. I'll keep my comments brief so Representative Liebling can get on to her next appointments. Just want to give you a little background about child mental health needs, which I suspect won't be news to you, but just so we're all on the same page. 1 in 5 kids in Minnesota have a chronic mental health condition, ADHD, depression, anxiety, but 45% of those kids aren't getting the care that they need. In 2016, 12% of our adolescents endorsed that they had seriously considered suicide in the past year. So we know there's a need. We also know that primary care providers are really the front line of care for our kids and youth. And at the University of Minnesota, we train the majority of pediatricians in the state. So 70% of the practicing pediatricians in the state of Minnesota get their training in the University of Minnesota program. So we really want to take the opportunity to build on the relationship that pediatricians have with their patients and to get kids and families what they need when they need it. What we're asking for is infrastructure to really build high-quality education and partnerships between pediatricians and trained child mental health professionals so that during their training, our pediatric residents can really get experience with early diagnosis, initiating treatment, and referring when appropriate for mental health care. What we think we're doing here really would put us at the leading edge of training for mental health care issues in children. I'm going to let my colleague, Dr. Katie Steingraber, who is a child psychiatry fellow at the University of Minnesota, just talk briefly about her experiences, and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, and welcome to the committee, Dr. Steinberger.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Katie Steingraber, a current fellow in the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Training Program at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for hearing this bill today. Dr. Borman Shope has already provided the background for this bill and has outlined the startling statistics which indicate that the number of children suffering from psychiatric illness continues to grow. Given this, I would like to focus my time today on clinical experience and will begin with a patient example. My colleague recently saw a patient who waited 9 months to receive care for their psychiatric illness. During this time, the patient had 3 suicide attempts by overdose, and it ended up in the pediatric intensive care unit for management. The patient's first opportunity to receive treatment for their depression was on our inpatient psychiatric unit. In our outpatient child and adolescent psychiatry clinic at the University of Minnesota, it is not uncommon for patients to be on the wait list for at least 3 to 6 months after being referred before they are able to establish with a provider in our clinic. Generally, the patients I see for evaluation in our clinic are complex and require acute treatment. Many of these patients have been referred appropriately by their pediatrician, who did not feel comfortable managing the patient's illness. While on the wait list for our clinic, it is not uncommon for the patient's symptoms to progress and lead to a decline in functioning, socially, academically, and psychologically, before they gain access to treatment. In my experience, the ramifications of functional decline for an adolescent tend to be felt widespread by peers, by their teachers, by their family members, and by their community. Many of these patients experience mild symptoms in the early stages of their illness. When mild symptoms are identified and managed, patients are much more likely to thrive in their development than a patient experiencing significantly impairing symptoms. Through this new training program, pediatric residents will learn the skills to effectively identify mental health symptoms early on in a patient's illness and initiate treatment immediately. As the incidence and prevalence rates of mental health diagnoses in children continue to rise, we, as child and adolescent psychiatrists, will unfortunately not and will not be able to address this need with the current or projected number of child and adolescent psychiatrists in the state, even as additional training positions are opened. Your support of this bill would allow for the necessary training to increase pediatricians' expertise in triaging, assessing, and managing patients with mental health conditions, all of which will allow for better care of Minnesota's youth struggling with mental health diagnoses, like the patient I previously described, and provide increased accessibility to child and adolescent psychiatrists so that they may provide care for the most complex and severe patients. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just would point out, in the interest of time, just for people, I think you have in your packets a letter from NAMI, which is an extraordinarily strong letter, I would say, about the need for this kind of a program.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. Are there many members in the audience that would like to testify on House File 5040?
I certainly might just ask to stand up. It's our Pediatric Advocacy Day at the Capitol, so I think we'd keep you here all afternoon if we let them all share their experience, but maybe the pediatricians and pediatric residents in the room, if you just want to stand up and wave so they can see who you are.
Well, thank you for doing that. It was always wonderful to have students here and who are definitely committed to learning and to helping our state, so thank you very much for that. Members, are there any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And testifiers, I have a niece that's doing residency at Children's, and I think it's PEDS. This is through the U, but what hospital locations would the training be done at?
Yeah, so we have kind of a...
1 second. Dr. Borman Schulp.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm a quick talker as a resident. The University of Minnesota Residency Training Program has a unique setup in that our trainees work in multiple clinical sites throughout the metro area. So they do clinical training at University of Minnesota Masonic Children's Hospital, Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, and Hennepin County Medical Center for their inpatient training. But they also work in a wide variety of outpatient clinical practices to get their general outpatient PEDS practice. So what we've designed is a way of making sure that we bring mental health expertise to all of those settings, but particularly focusing on the general outpatient pediatric piece, because they see the kids that Dr. Steingraber talked about who are really sick, who've had an overdose, and for us that should be a never event that a child is in the ICU because they've overdosed. So we want to equip our trainees with the skills so that when they graduate and they see someone in clinic, they'll know what to do when a teenager says, well, I've been cutting myself and I'm feeling pretty down, that the pediatrician won't say, oh, my gosh, you have to go see psychiatry. I don't know what to do. So it will impact trainees really throughout the metro and greater Minnesota, because many of our graduates go on to work in Duluth and Hutchinson and Alexandria and all throughout the state.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. I felt it was key that we understand this is, even though it looks like it's the U, it's broader across the region of the state. And then offline, it might be nice to have a rest of the story on, you know, children with mental health illness. That's continuing to grow and what the contributors are so that, you know, just for background. But thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious as to where within, I suppose, the U medical schools is this coming from. I mean, I'm hoping it's coming from them and not from, like, legislators. I mean, this is something that the grassroots, the people who are involved want and know what they want out of it.
Who would like to respond? Dr. Borman Schulp.
Yeah. It seemed like a good idea at the time when I got married, and I've spent a long time explaining the hyphenation. this is quite unusual. I recognize that, and I think the fact that it explicitly names University of Minnesota also has led us to visit many committees. This has really been a grassroots effort. So it started in January 2017. There was an article published in our big journal, Pediatrics, with our big governing bodies, the American Board of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Pediatrics, basically naming that this is a national problem. It's not just a Minnesota problem, that pediatricians don't feel equipped to really be that frontline point of care for kids with common mental health problems. And so I came back from my winter break to an email from one of my psychiatry colleagues that I knew a little but not well, and a bunch of other people who I hadn't yet met saying, hey, this is a problem. We should really do something about this. And so we just started meeting and talking about what could we do and who are champions, and I've come to know our colleagues at NAMI who've been wonderful at helping us understand the landscape of different things that are happening to support child mental health. We have partnered with Senator Greg Claussen on the Senate side because he has an interest in child mental health, but this really has been a grassroots effort from people who are involved in the training of pediatricians and psychiatrists at the university, looking for partnership in a number of avenues. And really, it's a healthcare workforce issue and an education issue. I think it's the intersection of the two, and recognize that we're going about it in a way that's a little unusual, but it we're hopeful to find partnership in a lot of ways. And I think certainly seeing, I think I counted there were 60 bills coming from the House and Senate that had mental health as key terms. So I think it's something we're all thinking about a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helps.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great explanation. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions by other members? Okay. Representative Liebling, would you like to make some finishing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for hearing the bill and, again, for letting me go first. And I would appreciate your support. Obviously, this does fill a really vital need. And I think if you read that NAMI letter, it really lays that out pretty well as well from another point of view. But, yes, there's a lot of discussion right now about children's mental health and our workforce shortages around having treatment professionals for that. So I think that training our pediatricians to do a better job and handled more of this in the first instance would really be very helpful.
Right. Thank you very much. Hearing no further discussion, I would like to renew my motion that House File 1540 refer to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we will go on to the next person then, right? Okay. In our packets, we have the minutes for March 5th, 2019. Would anyone like to make a motion to approve these minutes?
So move, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vang. Representative Vang moves approval of the minutes for March 5th, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Tap. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 5th, 2019 are approved. Perfect timing, Representative Mann. And with this one, in the interest of time and respect to the people we have shown up to testify today, I'll ask that members save their question until all our testifiers have a chance to testify. And the bill on our agenda right now is House File 684. Would any members like to move that motion, move that bill to be referred to Ways and Means?
So move.
Okay. So Representative Lean moves that House File 684 be referred to Ways and Means. And welcome to the committee, Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. Today I will be talking about House File 684, which would establish a Rare Disease Advisory Council. The state of Minnesota has been a leader in medical advancement and patient care, with institutions like the Mayo Clinic, the U of M, and other world-class hospital systems. People travel from all over the world to get their care here in Minnesota. However, we do have a bit of a gap when it comes to rare diseases. A rare disease is one in which it affects less than 200,000 people in the U.S., and this is an interesting bit of information. It's a disease for which there is no reasonable expectation that the cost of developing and making available a drug for such a disease will be recovered from sales of that drug. Therefore, only about 5% of rare diseases have any kind of treatment, and there are about 7,000 rare diseases. So what House File 684 would do is to establish a rare disease council with the University of Minnesota that would include physicians, nurses, hospital administrators, patients with rare diseases or their caregivers, social workers, pharmacists, dentists, genetic counselors, and representatives from healthcare companies, medical research, and biotechnology industry. It would also include some members of the House and the Senate. Their duties, among others, would be developing recommendations relating to the quality and access of treatment, developing a list of publicly accessible resources for patients and providers, identifying best practices for care, identifying unique problems faced by patients with rare diseases, as well as their families. With me today in the audience is Ms. Erica Barnes, who has been a champion for this cause and this legislation, and she would be happy to take any questions as well as I, if you have any.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions? Okay, so as we're going to, Ms. Barnes is going to come down and sit at the table just in case, and what I'd like to do is move your author's amendment to put the bill in the form that you would like.
Yes, please.
So I got to see what the bill, what the amendment number
A1
is. Okay, so it is H-O-684-A-1, and I'd like to move that to get it in the form that you would, the author would like. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Thank you and welcome to our committee, Ms. Barnes.
Thanks for having me.
So do we have any... Okay, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had a little experience with putting together an advisory council that, you know, didn't come from the grassroots. I mean, it was formed by the legislature, kind of top down. So that's one thing I see as I'm curious about that. And secondly, the list of duties is very, very broad and unfocused. So who will decide the work plan? How will that, you know, come together? What will it really be charged with, I guess, is my question.
Sure. Ms. Barnes.
I can give you an abbreviated story of the inception of the council, but it's kind of extraordinary. Actually, it truly started in my kitchen one day a couple years ago when I told my husband that I lost a child to a rare disease, and as I advocated for, as I tried to fundraise for rare disease, and then as I advocated for the needs of the rare disease community, I met so many moms whose child's diagnoses were very different than my daughter, but what I was seeing was, I almost verbatim, they were saying the same things to me over and over again, you know, delayed diagnosis, doctors and pediatricians with very little information about the disease, people not really understanding the disease, so not sometimes not believing the moms. And I was hearing the story over and over again. And along with that, I was just, the more I tried to raise money for research, the more I realized that the stakeholders in the rare disease space are everywhere. And we know that healthcare is a little bit siloed, but when it comes to rare disease patients, it's the problem is much, much worse. And so those two things really made me tell my husband, I really think we need to approach rare diseases from a policy standpoint And so I'd heard about a rare disease advisory council passing in the state of North Carolina. So I reached out to the person who runs that. I talked to her. And then at the time, I was working almost full-time. And so I contacted the National Organization for Rare Disorders for some direction. And they said, well, start contacting legislators and see if you can find someone who would be interested in authoring that bill. So I reached out to a couple of them, and I hope I have time to tell the story because it's actually kind of beautiful. I last year reached out to Matt Dean. He was one of the legislators I reached out to, and I never told him the disease that my daughter passed away from, but he was passionate about the council. And after we had already talked about the bill and he had agreed to author it, he told me kind of in passing, you know, I have connection to rare diseases. My wife lost two siblings to a rare disease, and he said, I'm sure you've never heard the name of it. And he said it, and I said, that's the disease I lost my daughter to. So of the 7,000 rare diseases, he had a personal connection. And so truly it was very grassroots. And then I reached out to Representative Mann, knowing that she's a practicing physician. And, of course, when we talked, she understood immediately some of the needs of the community, and I love not having to define terms for her, medical terms. It saves us a lot of time. So that's kind of the inception of the council. As far as the duties, I know it's really robust, but again, this kind of speaks to the amazing passion of researchers and physicians in the state of Minnesota. I've had a personal relationship with Jacob Toller, who's now the dean of the medical school, and some of the Mayo doctors who treated my daughter, and all of them understand that it's a broad mandate, but it has to be done. I mean, rare disease patients really face so many barriers. And so it's all of the stakeholders will have a very big job, but they're all willing to do it, and they've been really supportive all along the way.
Okay.
It's
Representative Runbeck.
It's going to be, it will be interesting, and I'm sure, but you found good people that are willing to be a part of it. How did the name, the name is your daughter's?
Yeah.
Your name.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Cleburne.
Madam Chair and members, I would just like to say I really encourage this bill. In my community, we have had physicians come in and speak about the rare diseases that impact many people in the state of Minnesota, and they really do feel like an island when they're out there working with their medical teams. And the doctors who are engaged in this type of work are passionate about the work, and I am confident that they have the intellectual capability to put together a great team to do this work. And so I would just like to encourage support of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to maybe hear some more about, there's one other state that has something similar, and has it been around long enough? Are they seeing positive outcomes in their state that you could tell us about?
Sure. So it's North Carolina, and I believe this is their third year of having the council. I know that last year they were able to secure funding from the National Science Foundation, a $3 million grant to work on a project to make resources more available to physicians. I know they're working on that, so I don't know exactly where the actual project is. But I know that they've made some good progress, and I know that the individual who runs that council says that she's told every time she reports back to the North Carolina legislature, they say this is money well spent, and they're always very happy to have her continue her work. So if you want specifics, she's given me some specifics on what they've accomplished. I can pass those along.
Okay. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I talked with somebody from the Epilepsy Foundation who is in my office who is very supportive of this, and I learned a lot about epilepsy, and I don't know if that's considered a rare disease. I think it's a pretty common disease, but I'm just trying to find here where it says, maybe it doesn't in the bill, when the sun sets. I mean, is this... Do you envision this advisory council as going on into the future, or have other advisory councils met for a period of time and then handed off their recommendations, which were then implemented? Or how do you picture this?
Do you want me to say, or do you want to say for that one? So the bill
is Barnes.
I'm sorry. The bill doesn't have a sunset, as I understand. So I think that there's going to be a lot to do. Right now it doesn't have a sunset.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair. And we've asked for funding for 2 years, but we don't have a time that the council will cease to exist. And what happens with diseases like this is that there's always new information, especially when you go looking for it. And so it's not very realistic to say they're going to work for 2 years and then give out their recommendations and be done, because it's not going to work that way, right? The recommendations are going to be constant, and they're going to be new every year and always coming in. So ideally, it'll be a council that exists forever, because these rare diseases will exist forever and we will find new ones. The funding mechanism for that after 2 years obviously will be up for debate.
Representative Lehman.
Madam Chair, that's what I was hoping to hear you say, because I mean, sometimes the government's role is to get something launched, and then if you are proving to be of value, that you will attract funding. And it sounds like this might be the situation here, I would hope. Yeah, thank you.
Any other question for members? Representative Lucere.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess the question is for the bill author. Regarding the appropriation, it looks like there's $150,000 appropriated in each of the next 2 years of the biennium. How did you arrive at that figure?
Good question.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So that was negotiated between all the members of the group that has been working on this legislation. Part of that money will go for a director for the council, who will put everything together, essentially, and be in charge. Space to meet, transportation, travel, things of that nature. The website and IT costs, we want to have a place where people can go and find this information. So that's where that number was derived from.
Okay. Well, thank you, members. And would you like to do some closing remarks for your bill?
Sure. As a primary care physician, when someone walks into my office with something rare, it's very scary for me. Can't even imagine how scary it is for the patient. And to have a place where I can go to get information to best help that patient with something I've never seen before would be amazing. To have a place where a family and a patient can go to for them to have direction of where should I take my child with this would be incredible. So I think this is it would be a really important council to have that would help a lot of people.
Well, thank you very much. And with that, hearing no further discussion, I'll renew my motion that House File 684, as amended, be referred to Ways and Means. Oh, excuse me, it was Representative Lean's motion. Yes, thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and your bill. Representative Vang.
Other agencies.
Oh, welcome to the testifying. I was going to welcome you to the committee, but you're already in the committee. Welcome to testify on your bill today, Representative Vang. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move my bill.
Representative Maine would like to move House File 977 to be laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Representative Vang, for the record, here to present on House File 977 on appropriating $375,000 during fiscal year 2020 and 2021 to College Possible to support their programs. I am myself a is a college possible alumni. Being the first in my family to graduate from my four-year college, I owe many thanks to College Possible to help me transition from high school and going to college. Back then, I had no idea what the landscape of applying for college looked like. Essentially, I didn't have a plan on how to apply for college. The only colleges I knew were the U of M, North Hennepin, or St. Cloud. College Possible was able to help me be strategic in finding the right college for me. What I appreciated the most was the one-on-one attention I received from the coach, who was able to see the potential in me beyond what I could see for myself. She gave me an application one day. She said, "Hey, Sam, I think you can apply for the scholarship." And it's actually a full-ride scholarship to an Ivy League school. I applied for it, and I made it as a finalist. However, the closest I got to entering an Ivy League school was being waitlisted. Despite that endeavor, I still went to a fulfilling college over at Gustavus. Another thing I appreciate the most is that paying for college applications is a major hurdle for many low-income students. They can range from $75 to a couple hundred. And this is a fee that not a lot of students, at least for me, was not aware of until I started applying for colleges. So College Possible takes away that barrier by paying for all the college application fees, thus increasing the students' chances of getting accepted, as well as the students being able to choose the college of their choice. So, in essence, being able to attend college is a turning point for many students, especially for low-income students who often imagine college as a faraway, unaffordable prospect. People don't realize that having a choice to attend college, especially a choice to attend the one right for you, is a luxury. And low-income students tend to have obligations and responsibilities to support their families, often sacrificing their education over for work. And so College Possible uplifts low-income students by giving them a choice, and I think that is very empowering. I do have a few testifiers here with me who can explain more about the program and the experiences at College Possible.
Thank you. If you could say your name and the organization, that would be great, and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Jook. I'm the Executive Director at College Possible. First of all, thank you to Representative Vang for being an author of our bill and an alumna of our program, and thank you to all of you for hearing our testimony today. College Possible is an organization that started right here in Minnesota that's focused on supporting low-income students on their path to and through college through coaching and support. With the support of the state of Minnesota, we've been able to significantly grow our program in recent years. We now work with 2,500 high school students at 67 high schools across the state. Those students, their average household income is less than $30,000. 90% of those students are first-generation college students, and 94% of those students are students of color. We support those students through high school and the path to earn college admission, and we continue that support all the way through college graduation. So today we're working with 5,000 college students. 90% of our students stay and attend school right here in Minnesota, and are pretty evenly divided between the Minnesota State University system, the University of Minnesota system, the private college system, and community colleges. So we find that our 5,000 college students are really spread across the state pursuing their studies. And now we have more than 2,000 college graduates that are working and volunteering and serving in leadership roles and being elected to key positions in our state that are right here in our state and in our community. We, as an organization and as a program, our results are unmatched. 98% of our students earn admission to college, and our students are four times more likely to earn their college degree than their low-income peers. We have extensive education evaluations, including a Harvard randomized control trial, showing the impact of our programs. We operate at approximately one-sixth the cost of similar programs, and economist Peter Hegard has calculated a 300% return on investment. So we've had tremendous success here, keeping an efficient program, taking a program to scale here in the state of Minnesota. We have had support from the state of Minnesota for the past few years, and that's really what has allowed us to expand
beyond being a Twin Cities program to being a program that reaches students across all corners of the state. And with continued funding, we would be able to continue that support to students across the state and also expand some critical work for us. We're doing some new strategic programming really in partnership with higher ed institutions, so that instead of us just coaching the students on the campus that are college possible students, we are forming deep partnerships with higher ed institutions across the state to build infrastructure on those campuses to reach more low-income students. So supporting not just college possible students, but other low-income students on the campus, and building a framework and a structure that will be sustainable for that campus moving forward to continue to provide successful support for their low-income students. At this point, I'd love to turn it over to, we have two other people testifying in support of the bill today.
If you could state your name and your organization for the committee, that appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for hearing us. My name is Kumar Balasubramanian. I am the Senior Manager of Community Partnerships and Engagement at College Possible. I do have some folders with information about our program for each of you, so if you could help distribute that, would be great. Thank you so much. So I was born and raised right here in St. Paul, and after graduating college, I felt the call to do something to give back to the community that had given so much to me. And growing up, I had known quite a few students who were part of this program, and I knew that education was a life-changing event for my family, and I wanted to provide that to others. So I chose to serve with College Possible as an AmeriCorps member, and after 2 years working with a group of 40 high school students in their junior and senior year at Robbinsdale Cooper High School, my career trajectory changed, and I knew that education was the place that I wanted to be. And so over the past 8 years, I've continued to work with College Possible in a variety of positions, including 6 years focusing on our programming, and the past 2 years working on external relations and connecting with other organizations in our community doing good work. And I think there's three main things that during that time that I would want to share with this committee. And so the first one is that the future of our state is extremely bright. The students that I have interacted with are incredible. They're intelligent, hardworking, creative. They're representing us in really positive ways. And they are the change makers that I think our state really needs to see the brighter tomorrow. The second thing, though, is that the barriers that exist in accessing and then succeeding when getting to college are very, very real. And in particular, for students of color, for students who are the first in their family to be attending college. Things like financial aid, the application process, imposter syndrome when getting on a campus, even feeling like they're welcome there, are true barriers and challenges that our students face. And despite their intelligence and persistence and potential, their opportunities are not always fully realized, and that's oftentimes for things that are outside of their control. And then the third thing that I would say is I've witnessed over my past 8 years with College Possible that through an intensive and well-designed and researched program, those barriers can be mitigated and overcome in support of our students. And I think at the heart of what we do is mentorship. Getting to know a student, giving them that one-on-one time, listening to them, hearing what they need, what do you want to do, and how can I help you get there? And we do that in a unique way. We use a near-peer mentor model. So all of the people who are supporting the students in our program are recent college graduates themselves. And I think that there is so much power in making those close connections. So thank you all so much for listening to me. Thank you, Representative Vang. And I'd like to pass it over to our last testifier, who is another alumni from our program.
Thank you and welcome. Please state your name, and it sounds like you're representing the alumni, but you can also share anything else you'd like about who you're with.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Vincent Henry, Jr., and I am a resident of District 59A. I would like to speak with you all today about my experience with College Possible, both as a student, similar to Representative Vang, and also as a former coach. And hopefully through my testimony, you will see the powerful impact College Possible is making throughout our cold and beautiful state of Minnesota and beyond on a national level. In the spring of 2009, my parents moved my younger brother and I from St. Louis Park, where we had lived for 7+ years, all the way across 394 to Golden Valley. As a teenager, this move was a huge challenge for me because I had built relationships and a support system that I felt I had to leave behind. I was also leaving a school district that I had been in for so long, and as an introvert, starting at a new school was terrifying. But I had remembered that in my sophomore year, I had been accepted into a program called Admission Possible, now College Possible. One of the first things I did after starting at my new school, Robbinsdale Armstrong, was to find the admission possible office to find out if I would be able to transfer into the cohort. Fortunately for me, I was accepted. Like I had mentioned earlier, I'm extremely introverted, and nothing makes that more clear than being thrown into a new environment with a bunch of new people. But what helped me through the anxiety of getting acclimated to this new place was College Possible. With regular after-school sessions every week, I quickly grew a community of support around me, including my coach and peers, that lasted throughout my final 2 years of high school. On top of finding a place of belonging in high school, College Possible also supported me through my journey to college acceptance and ultimately college graduation with a bachelor's degree in business and economics. This support included ACT prep courses in junior year, where I was able to increase my score by 5 points. During senior year, college and financial aid applications were the focus, which resulted in me being accepted into 5 bachelor granting institutions, including my dream school, Augsburg College, where I went to college. And lastly, my college coach's ongoing support throughout my journey to college graduation, including pushing me to do things that would help me with my development, such as running for student government, connecting me with helpful resources, and providing a safe space on campus to wind down after a long day of classes. Following graduation, I made the decision to give back to the organization that had given so much to me by serving as a high school coach at Roosevelt and Edison High School. These 2 terms of service through AmeriCorps proved to be a life-changing experience. I not only had the privilege to collaborate with amazing human beings like Sarah and Kumar, but I was also given the great opportunity and important responsibility to impact young people's lives. I would like to share with you a story about one of my students, Jasmine. I met Jasmine in the beginning of her junior year at Roosevelt High School. Like many teenagers, Jasmine was unsure of her direction, but had the desire to work hard and be successful. However, due to circumstances at home with verbal abuse, she had low self-esteem, which came through in various conversations I've had with her about her future. Through constant encouragement and goal setting with Jasmine, her confidence grew. One day, while sitting in my office, Jasmine announced that she had been accepted into the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I was ecstatic, and all I could say to her was, "I am so proud of you." Her response was an emotion-filled, "That is the first time someone has ever said that to me." Moments like these are what makes College Possible, College Possible. The after-school session curriculum is great, actually top-notch, like previously stated. But it is the relationships built between students and the College Possible coaches that make College Possible stand out as an organization that truly makes an impact. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, do we have any, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question, I guess, is to the bill authors. I'm looking at the language here, beginning on line 1.9 through 1.12. So 1.9 reads, students through an intensive curriculum of coaching and support at both the high school and post-secondary levels. Then I go down to letter B. To the extent possible, this appropriation must be proportionately allocated between students from Greater Minnesota and students in the 7-county metropolitan area. So are you referring to college students or high school students that are attending a college in the 7-county metro area, or that, so if they're living, if they had grown up in the metro but they're attending a college out in the 80 counties outside of the 7-county metro area, or vice versa, or however you... If you just provide clarity on what that means.
Yeah, I think I, Representative Vang,
can refer this to Kumar.
Okay, go ahead, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, let me just try. Mr. Balasubramanian.
You nailed it. Yeah. Madam Chair, you're amazing. Yeah, my last name is quite long. Bowl of soup and onions has been a good mnemonic for people in the past. Thank you so much for the question. And that is a key point for clarity. So what that means is that we have students who are originally from Greater Minnesota, the counties outside of the metro area, and we support them through high school and through college. And then it also does include our students who were born and raised here in the metro area but are attending institutions throughout Greater Minnesota. So it's a mix of both of those communities, and
you know, the appropriation support that we get is just a piece of our larger budget, and so we create what we call an appropriation cohort, where we identify students who are either in high school or college in Greater Minnesota and who are in high school or college in the metro area, and make sure that there's as much of a balance between the two as we can when we utilize these specific funds.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you. So just to follow up, I'm just looking for greater clarity here. So let's, if 100% of the funds were allocated to students that went to high school in the 7-county metro area but are attending college in outside the 7-county metro area, would that satisfy this criteria?
Mr. Bolasubramanian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is not our approach to it. We have a significant high school programming throughout Greater Minnesota, and that is specifically funded by this. But I do see where you're coming from with that language being maybe a little bit unclear. But I think our goal is to support students throughout the state and to use the state funding to support students who are originally from Greater Minnesota, who are, as well as students who are living and getting educated throughout the state.
Representatives,
thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I understand the intent. It's just the words are extremely vague, I guess, was the point. So the next question I would have is, why College Possible? I think I heard in the testimony that there are other nonprofits that are in this space. Why are we allocating, and maybe this is to the bill author, then why are we choosing this particular nonprofit rather than potentially a grant program where others could compete for these dollars?
Representative Vang.
I think, I have more exposure to College Possible, and I think the other programs like TRIO and such, I don't know too much about their programs to speak on their differences between College Possible. I can refer to my testifier to see if they can explain more on that. And
okay, Ms. Juk.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative, we are the only statewide program that works with students from high school all the way through college graduation. So while there may be other college access programs in the state and other college success programs in the state, none have the scale that we do as an organization. Also, our results as an organization are unmatched by other programs. We were the first program in the country to have RCT level evidence that our program makes an impact on students to the extent that it does. So in terms of scale within the state, a program that starts in high school, goes all the way through college, unmatched results, and then you layer in the cost effectiveness that we operate at 1/6 the cost of similar programs, would be the reason that we have been strong partners for the last 4+ years.
Okay, Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is more of a comment than a question. I just really want to thank Representative Vang for bringing this forward. What excites me about being on the Higher Education Committee is the fact that the work that we do here doesn't just affect the students. It doesn't just affect those individuals or those families. The work that we do and what I think that your legislation will do will help all Minnesotans, because by reaching out, you know, giving these students the tools that they need will help them succeed, and by doing that, that will really help us compete in a 21st century economy as Minnesotans. So I just want to thank the testifiers, I want to thank Representative Vang, and I think this is a good bill for all Minnesotans.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got so many questions. I'll try and limit it. But this is the first I've heard of this organization. And I live up in Itasca County, the Grand Rapids area. And I do see Itasca Community College listed here as a partner of some sort. But my first question, I just want to play off of what Representative Lucero said, because I would strongly suggest that you consider changing the word on 1.12 from Greater Minnesota to in Greater Minnesota. Because the way it's worded right here, basically you could be doing all of your work in the 7-county metro area and nothing in Greater Minnesota. So I think that would really be helpful. And it sounds like you're amenable to that. Okay. Thank you. Second question is, it looks like you have been receiving funding from the legislature since 2014. So my question is, what is your, kind of a three-part, what is your total budget? What have you received in the past from the state? And are you asking for more? And if so, is it for expansion purposes or what purpose? So total budget, what are you receiving from other people versus what are you receiving from us? And then what would you be using this additional money for? Thank you.
Okay, who would like to respond? Ms. Jerk. No, Jerk. Is it?
Jerk.
Jerk. Yep.
Madam Chair, Representative. So the first question, our total budget is $6 million. We, in the past 4 years, have received $250,000 a year from the state of Minnesota. So as Kumar had mentioned, that's a portion of the students that we're serving, and so we have traditionally identified a cohort that the $250,000 will support. The beginning of the support, though, really was the time that we went from being College Possible Twin Cities to College Possible Minnesota. Before we received the first year of funding, we were working in 25 high schools in the Twin Cities. Today we are working in 67 high schools across the state. And so we've been able to use those funds, along with funds from the Bush Foundation and the Otto Bremer Foundation, to expand our work and create programming for students from across the state. And so what we are asking for the next 2 years is an increase from that $250,000 a year to $375,000 a year, which provides the funding to continue to support that expanded work throughout the state, but would also support that new partnership work that we are doing with higher ed institutions to work closely with them to build infrastructure to support not only College Possible students on their campus, but all low-income students on their campus. What we found is that our students do, as I mentioned in my earlier testimony, graduate at four times the rate of their low-income peers. And so in partnership with institutions to not only reach those College Possible students, but other low-income students, we are confident that we can increase those persistence and graduation rates with low-income students across the state. And so the additional funding would allow us to expand those programs. Currently, that in-depth program is at St. Cloud State, Augsburg, St. John's, and St. Ben's. We would look to use the funds to grow programming at those institutions and identify an additional public institution in the state that we would be able to start that new line of programming to support all low-income students.
Okay, Madam Chair, just a follow-up. So just to clarify, the $6 million budget, the remaining funds come from foundations?
Ms. Jook.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, so the remaining funds are primarily private philanthropy from corporations, foundations. We have 1,000 individual donors from the state of Minnesota that provide funds. We've also received some competitive federal grants and some AmeriCorps federal dollars. Because we are an AmeriCorps program, we do receive support from the Corporation for National and Community Service for our AmeriCorps members. But of the $6 million, approximately $5 million is private philanthropy.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you,
Andrew. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was referenced a report that it's one-sixth the cost than other programs. Can the committee receive a copy of that report?
Yeah, it sounds like yes. Yeah. Okay, thumbs up. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Representative Brumbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on line 1.13, it talks about programs supporting students, basically. First question is, does any money go directly to the student? And what are the dollars actually? What kind of programs are being supported by the dollars?
Ms. Jack.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have historically not been a scholarship granting organization, so all of the dollars that we have raised are providing the coaching and the support for the students. So the costs, more than 80% of the dollars raised are going directly in support of students and programming. So it's to the stipends of the coaches that are working with those students. It is transportation for students. It is food for students. It is all the miscellaneous expenses that go with program delivery. And our support for students is really that after-school session activity in the high school program and in the college program. It's the frequent interactions that coaches will have with their students to support them and help them navigate all aspects of college.
And a follow-up, Madam
Yes,
Chair?
Representative Rumbeck.
So are you restricted to encouraging these students to go to colleges per se, or is it any post-secondary that you will guide them to?
Ms. Jook.
Madam Chair, Representative, when we recruit students to join our program, we are really looking for students that have their eye on attending a four-year institution, because our research shows that often low-income students do not consider four-year institutions as a possibility, and we want to make sure that that is an option for them. But that said, we support our students no matter where they ultimately attend school. And so, as I mentioned, we've got about a quarter of our students that attend community college. We support them all the way through whether a community college degree is their end goal or a transfer from a community college to a four-year college is their goal. We will support our students that attend community college. We support our students that attend both public and private institutions. At the end of the day, our goal is that a student reaches their educational dream and gets to that educational outcome, whatever that may look like.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Whoa. Any other, would you like to, and I do need to give a shout out for Representative Lee. I know he's been supportive of this initiative, and I believe is a college possible alumnus. I wanted to give a shout out for him too. And Representative Vang, do you have anything that you would like to, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just I would appreciate everyone's support. Thank you.
Thank you. Hearing no further discussion, Representative Vang renews her motion that House File 977 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over. Representative Nornes, we're going to be hearing your bill next.
You allotted me 30 minutes, am I correct
yes,
on that?
Yes, you have 30 minutes or less if you would like. Well, it all depends on all the questions and the testifiers.
Okay, I expect less than 30 probably.
Right. Well, welcome, and welcome to the testifying station, and would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 1201.
Okay.
And that's to be held over, I assume, for possible inclusion.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Thank you very much. So we have the bill before us, and would you like to make opening remarks?
Yeah, brief remarks. In the last biennium, it was brought to my attention, like other parts of our economy, the aviation industry was looking at a shortage of people to fly and fix airplanes. So we passed the initial legislation that started a loan forgiveness program for those pursuing that career. So that was done in the last biennium, and today we're here to make some adjustments, I think, to that. It's been a good program, I think. It's been successful. We could have used a lot more funding because the need is definitely there, and we'll hear that from the testimony in a few minutes, I think. So this bill basically just changes some definitions, and also one of the requirements for someone in this program was that they had to, whatever, if they're a mechanic or whatever, they had to serve in that area for a year. We've decided that's probably too short a time. So this bill actually extends the work obligation to 5 years, which seems reasonable. So with that, I'd like to turn the testimony over to my two testifiers to introduce themselves. And I know one gentleman came from a distance, I believe. Safer for Falls, am I correct?
Duluth.
Duluth, even further than
okay.
that.
Okay, is that so, Daniel Fanning? Okay, please state your name and your organization for the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I represent Lake Superior College. We're one of a handful of aviation schools who are members of Minnesota's state system. We, along with other campuses throughout the state, do have an aviation program, and exactly as the gentleman mentioned, we have a growing program, which is fantastic, but we have a growing need that outpaces our growth. So we work closely in our backyard of Duluth and the Twin Ports. We work closely with AAR and Cirrus and Delta, Sun Country, and increasingly Southwest, and simply put, we cannot graduate students fast enough. And this program has been very helpful in helping us recruit, retain, and to even continue to pull students from outside the area, outside of the state, which has been fantastic for our local economy and the state economy. Again, this program, as you mentioned, has been successful. I've talked to our community partners, including AAR and Cirrus, which is our two biggest aviation partners in Duluth. They are more than fine with extending this to 5 years because the majority of other employees do actually stick around for 5 years. It's a good workforce. The good news is that the aviation sector, not only in Duluth but throughout the state, is growing. The bad news is, again, is we simply cannot graduate students fast enough. So this gives us another tool in our toolkit to get that done. Some of the other initiatives that we get, including from AAR, some of those programs have sunset. So now it's a problem of trying to recruit more and more students to these industries because, as you all know well, this is one of the fastest growing industries, not only in the state, but this is really a national issue. We're working with Delta down in Georgia, and they're projecting that they're going to need about a quarter billion, $250 million additional employees over the next decade, looking at some of their workforce needs. And it's just the numbers are absolutely staggering. So it's an issue that already has serious opportunities and serious challenges, but it sounds like it's going to get better before it gets even worse. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on this, and thanks for your consideration.
Thank you very much. And Gordon Huff, would you like to go next?
Yes, my name is Gordon Huff. I'm a member of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association, and I had the privilege of working on this legislation during the last session when it was initiated. What we have before us today in House File 1201 and its companion 1181 in the Senate is mostly technical. We found out that when a loan is granted by the Office of Higher Education, the loan is granted for 5 years, and that's why we've increased it. So currently, a student in the pilot training can get up to $5,000 for 5 years, which means we've committed to $25,000 for one individual, and that's what we have for a total for the year. We also found out in working with the higher ed office when we drafted these technical amendments with their assistance, we had it was questionable whether a person who was in the airframe and power plant or AMT, aircraft maintenance technician program, would actually be able to qualify. So this language clarifies that completely so that now both pilots and, as we refer to them as AMTs, can apply. Now, the AMT has a less lengthy program. It's 2 years instead of four, and it also is less expensive, and so they can get up to $3,000 for the five-year period. So the bill is technical. We are requesting a $50,000 increase for the biennium, making a total of $100,000 so we can help more students. And in talking to Thief River Falls, they talk about the recruitment of the students has been a challenge because the airframe and power plant or aircraft maintenance technician is very rigorous, and you're competing with automobile maintenance technicians who have a less rigorous, and when the people graduate from the program, there's a lot of competition for those skills. We find amusement parks, railroads, and hazmat people because they have a lot of skills with electronics and sheet metal or plastics, and so the competition is fierce. Not most of the people from Thief River actually do graduate and go into aviation, but there's always that competition that they have to struggle with. You've heard of the shortage that's been mentioned, and we're finding that small FBOs, fixed base operators in small towns in rural Minnesota, are struggling to find an AMT that will allow them to offer maintenance on the aircraft that are based at their airport. So it helps them be more viable as a business. Also, in speaking with Bemidji Aviation, which operates, I think, something like 40 aircraft out of Bemidji, Minnesota, they've been struggling to hire the pilots. I talked to Tracy Walter, Vice President, earlier today at Bemidji Aviation, and they have had 9 applicants, and 4 of those passed the check ride. And then when they pass the check ride, there's other people who know they've passed the check ride, and they come along and offer even more money than Bemidji Aviation can afford. And so she says about 50% of the pilots that they recruit and train and pass the check ride actually are hireable. And then they lose a few of those. And the aircraft maintenance technician is also a challenge. They have, I think, 4 or 5 openings right now at their facility. And they fly a lot of Queen Airs, and they're mostly built in the 70s and 80s. And they're finding that the AMT programs focus on the airlines, and so they have they've developed their grow their own program, you might say, within the AMT side of it, where they work with they'll bring them in and they'll work with a certified aircraft maintenance technician, and then they will take the test after a few years of, you know, you might say, apprenticeship within the company, and they will then hopefully keep those people around for a longer period of time. Be happy to answer any questions if there are, but it's mostly technical in amendment and then request for $50,000 so we can help more students in the future.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I have a question. So we've just heard from College Possible, and we just heard about all their philanthropy that they've also brought in. Is there any effort on the part of Delta to put in money to help these mechanics and pilots? Because as I understand from our previous conversations, 2 of the schools are public and 1 is private. Is that correct?
That is correct, on the pilot side, yes.
Yes. And so then my main question is that, is there a partnership with Delta or any of the airline carriers to help these students be successful in this way?
Mr. Fanning.
Madam Chair, committee member, yes, there is. We actually, Lake Superior College, speaking specifically for my school, we just became an official partner of Delta last fall. We went through a rigorous program to actually get named. We were one of only 2 schools in the state of Minnesota, 1 of 36 schools throughout the country. So we were part of that work, and that progress is just starting to happen right now. So they gave us, please don't quote me on the number, I don't remember the exact number, but it was about $25,000 to help both with equipment donation as well as some scholarship funding. We're seeing more and more industry partners, including Cirrus and AAR, going that route as well. That certainly helps. That said, even though we offer one of the more affordable tuitions, this is one of our more expensive programs between this and nursing. So as you've heard, we're able to attract the students, but sometimes that initial sticker shock does deter them a little bit. So anything like this does help an awful lot.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes,
thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr.
Delta is also working with Mankato State I forget exactly what they're calling the program, but they have a very rigorous program there, and if the students in the pilot program, no DWIs, no speeding tickets even, if they meet their criteria and they graduate, and after they have reached, I think it's 1,100 hours because they have a special waiver from the FAA if you go to a qualified teacher certain, which they do at Duluth as well. So then they'll hire them at the Delta feeders or the regional airlines that work with Delta. And I think they I'm not sure how long they guarantee it, but Jeff Davidman, I know from Delta Aviation, is very supportive of what we're trying to do in this area.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nordis, thank you for bringing this.
This probably is something you're interested in.
Pay a little bit of attention to this one. I'm not here. I have a fancy job throwing luggage at the airport.
Yes.
I guess I'm not supposed to say throw. I gently place.
Yeah.
Gently place luggage. Whoops. Just lost.
Thank you.
Just lost my job,
for
maybe.
Doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, very gently placed.
Stays in the room here.
So, thank you for coming. It's, top to bottom in that industry, our employees are needed, and they're great jobs. The you know, and I know that the company that I work for really is making a huge effort of trying to hire, and I think they a very diverse workforce. I mean, they've got to be award-winning if they're not one of the leaders of the effort of getting a strong workforce. But there's jobs from top to bottom there, and they're good paying. And so I guess my question would be, maybe you can talk about, like, numbers a little bit, just so people around the table might get an idea of what a technician might make, or a pilot, or you know, even us fancy luggage placers. So,
thank you. Mr. Huff.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, when you graduate from Thief River Falls, according to Linda Glenn up there, who's the program administrator, she says they graduate and make $19 to $20 an hour when they leave school. I think at Duluth, I think they go to AR, and I think they're making $20 to $24 according to the gentleman who runs the aviation program at the school.
Starting
wages. For a pilot, you're going to graduate with a two-year school, and even the four-year school, you're going to probably have someplace in the vicinity of 120 to 250 hours. The high would be probably 250. So how do you get to 1,100? You do a lot of student flight training, and they're going to make around $20 an hour from what I'm told by the schools, both at Duluth and at Mankato. And the pilots are coming out, the high is $100,000, the low is $55,000 with debt at the Minnesota schools.
Okay, Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair, and thank you for kind of talking through some of that. It's I don't know if I watch a little bit of TV in the evening when I finally get home, and it's been kind of neat to see, especially Mankato, which you mentioned, and they have different ads that they do for their what's going on at MSU, and it's pretty neat. And one of them right now running is a female pilot that was inspired by her father, but she's often flying, and it's a pretty neat story, of at least to me, and it's pretty exciting. So, anyways.
Thank you.
I could, Madam Chair, share a personal story myself if you'd like to hear one. My grandson went to the prom. His date won a prize that took them up on an airplane flight for an hour. And he's hooked on flying. He's taking flying lessons right now. just soloed last week or 2 weeks ago. So it happens sometimes.
That's excellent. Okay, well, thank you, members, for your questions. And Representative Nornes, do you have any final comments?
No, I think I appreciate the hearing and the opportunity to talk about this very important issue. Can you imagine a world without pilots? I mean, we'd be in real trouble. So it's an important area that we need to encourage, and this does a little bit to do that. So thank you. And
Representative Nornes, did you want to renew your motion that House File 1201 be laid over for possible inclusion in the higher education omnibus bill?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
Thank you.
The bill is laid over. The meeting is adjourned.